As part of his ongoing series on data justice, WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer spoke to Ingrid Burrington about Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and Palantir.
There's like several different bad things happening at once that are treated sort of as like one kind of cohesive mess of a problem, and which are in distinct and kind of like meaningful ways, right? So like Facebook playing fast and loose and people kind of doing shady things with their data that like is available via a developer API. That's like one problem. Cambridge Analytica doing things that may have gotten some authoritarians and fascists elected. Also a problem. Those are treated, I feel like the way that this story has been told, it's sort of treated as like this, these are part of like one enormous set of things. Cause I don't think Facebook can do very much directly about Cambridge Analytica at this stage. And it's not in their business model to do anything about it. I want to see what a world would look like without Facebook, but I think I'm kind of in a minority on this position. It seems like we maybe are too late for asking that question.
I think the more serious issue that maybe isn't getting quite as much attention is the way that Facebook might be enabling ethnic cleansing with the Rohingya Muslim population. Is there anything happening on that front?
I would say I would give a huge credit to like Burmese civil society organizations who've been able to leverage the Cambridge Analytica outrage to draw attention to this issue, because I think it's been, I mean, a week before that story dropped, a special envoy to the United Nations basically said on the floor of the UN, like, yeah, there's ethnic cleansing happening and Facebook is implicated. And the reason Facebook's, you know, implicated is not because they personally have a stake, you know, in what happens to the Rohingya. It's that they have sort of, I guess you could say, like a sort of like dereliction of duty if you assume that they have any obligation to their Burmese users, by not having enough Burmese speaking content moderators, by having most of them nowhere near Myanmar, by having very limited kind of comprehension of like the content that they're looking at. They have created conditions that have gotten people documenting and reporting on crimes against humanity banned or having like content takedowns. They have people who are spreading misinformation and propaganda against the Rohingya staying on the platform and kind of manipulating the tendency of the news feed algorithm to push the most outrageous content to the top. They have sort of passively enabled a really effective propaganda engine, right? And in terms of like what's happening with that, there were a couple of people in the congressional hearing who brought that up and asked Zuckerberg about it. Zuckerberg's promise on this is that they're going to hire, his words, dozens more content moderators, and that they are, you know, kind of, I think he made, like, he used the phrase, like, we're going to build AI tools for, like, every f***ing thing that came up as, like, a problem related to speech, which is also really worrying. And he said that they're working on building a product team that will deal with problems like this in Myanmar. They're not building a product team who's directly working solely on problems in Myanmar. What's happening in Myanmar is probably the worst case scenario, but there are problems like this happening all over Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Vietnam, like misinformation and like ethnic tension and violence is like something that is happening in lots of different parts of the world. I think it's a pretty bold move to say one product team could deal with all of these very unique situations. Dozens is not really going to cut it in terms of having enough people whose job is to like look at content and know what's actually going on. Like the idea of like Facebook being a sort of like world speech police deciding what is and isn't acceptable is like deeply disconcerting, right? On the other, like Facebook hasn't really made an effort to invest in sort of local knowledge and expertise in these situations. Like I think one of like after an interview that he gave with Vox, where he talked a little bit about the Myanmar ethnic cleansing, a group of civil society groups from there wrote a letter to Mark, being like, "Cool story, bro. Where have you been for the last 4 years?" Facebook has never just had like on the ground staff there is like that's and in a way, like at a legal level, they put themselves in a really fragile place by doing that. So like I spent a little bit of time last winter just looking into what legal channels even exist for accountability for this sort of stuff, because I sort of naively thought like, all right, once we start talking about like literal genocides, like law has to come in, some adults have to show up. And some very nice human rights attorneys, you know, gently explained to me that there are no adults. When corporations are kind of implicated in human rights abuses around the world, there's in the United States, there's sort of this civil statute called the Alien Tort Statute. And it basically, it was created in the 1780s for piracy. So like literally people on boats, pirates. And the basic premise of it is if an American entity, individual or corporate, does something that kind of violates a law, or could be like, you could be tried in civil court for doing that, or like charges could be brought against you and it's happening somewhere else, the person from that other place can bring a case against you in the United States. This is typically used by people in countries where like oil companies or mining, like extractive industries, have had sort of like private police, or have like that have like committed abuses, or have been sort of like complicit in the agendas of like authoritarian governments. And typically these sorts of lawsuits, like at best, you get a settlement. In 2012, I think, a Supreme Court ruling related to like a Dutch Shell petroleum case basically set some really narrow parameters under which you can bring those sorts of lawsuits. Because if the actual harms were enacted, like on, you know, foreign soil by a subsidiary, technically, you can't bring a case. Like this is, you have to like address the company that actually did the harms, not the like chain of like, you know, shell companies that lead to like a corporation somewhere in the United States. So by not actually having any on the ground staff in a lot of these places, Facebook is like weirdly legally vulnerable, because all of these decisions that they're making that are contributing to like an incredibly, you know, volatile political situation, I think that they recognize that they have enough lawyers to throw this problem, that this sort of vulnerability doesn't occur to them as something that they really need to prepare for. But it is sort of, I think it's sort of like short-sighted, not only because like if you actually bothered to invest in like, you know, people who are on the ground to like govern the platforms like as they see fit, and to like help people like not die, you might not have these problems. And two, it does kind of just introduce this really interesting legal vulnerability that they're not doing anything about. So what are the interesting moments of that congressional hearing that I keep thinking about was one of the Congress people asked Mark Zuckerberg this really awkward leading question about Palantir. And I was really disappointed seeing lots of like my peers being like, yes, got in that Palantir zinger. Cause I was like, we learned nothing. And like everything was alluded to in this kind of like sloppy way. What I think that congressperson was getting at was like, it's thought that Palantir may have worked with or consulted with Cambridge Analytica. And Peter Thiel, who was one of the founders of Palantir, sits on Facebook's board, right? Like, but she didn't just say it, which I found sort of was like, why are you being so coy? Like, and it, she probably was being coy because all we have is that sort of circumstantial confluence of things, which mostly when you say it out loud makes you sound like someone making a conspiracy theory wall. I was really, really heartened by Ollie Winston's reporting for the Investigative Fund and The Verge looking at Palantir's work in New Orleans. Because I think, one, it actually concretely explained what they were doing. I think a lot of coverage of Palantir tends to have this very, like, it's spooky because we don't know sort of tone, which I feel like is, like, not helpful for actually thinking about what a strategy for, like, challenging systems looks like. And two, it articulated a really explicit like harm and like kind of like dropping of the ball by like institutions, because regardless of like whether they were like doing it by the book and doing like the right kind of predictive policing, which doesn't exist, like nobody knew it was happening, like because of the way that funding for that particular work was like kind of channeled through different outlets. And that is like a huge part of, I think, where companies like Palantir kind of get a pass. Is there's a sort of like every, if things are informal enough or are like through different kinds of like undocumented channels, things kind of can disappear, right? It's also interesting, like the way that in the Cambridge Analytica story, Palantir, the you know, Palantir employee who supposedly was like kind of consulting for them, Palantir has been like, oh, it was personal capacity only. Doesn't reflect anything about the company, which is the exact same thing they said about the work that somebody at Palantir was involved in with the consultant, the defense like consulting group HB Gary back in like 2011, 2012, when Anonymous dumped a bunch of emails from that company that showed that they had been working with Palantir and another contractor to make a pitch to basically the Chamber of Commerce to run a smear campaign against Glenn Greenwald because they were stressed out about WikiLeaks. This is the story that like got Barrett Brown on like the FBI's radar, and it's a lot of the subsequent work that he was doing that like put him in jail. And that Palantir employee who was kind of in the mix of that entire thing, like I think he got fired eventually, but like that was all treated as like, oh, like it's not us. It was just this one guy. We're not responsible. And the same logic, same arguments being made with the Cambridge Analytica stuff, which is like, that's convenient. It's convenient how you seemingly have no idea what your employees are doing at any given moment. And like, whenever they do something you don't like, they definitely weren't acting in your interests. Like, it seems weird for a company that's like thought to be so good at tracking what people do, that's so unable to recognize when its own employees are doing things that are questionable.